It's Friday, and it's now the 58th edition of the Zogby Report, Real and Unscripted. Jeremy and I have been doing this over a year now together and having a lot of fun, as a lot of you can tell. Coming at things from a different point of view many times. Sometimes we actually agree, but whatever it is, it's always civil and respectful, and thank you for enjoying it as much as you do. Hey, Jer, how are you?
Not too bad. How about you?
Good, thank you. We are in different states right now, just like the old days, okay? And so nice to see your face here. So, in going over last week's podcast, towards the tail end, the last few minutes, we hinted at a topic, and that was, to what degree will we change as humans, as Americans, after COVID? Just trying to speculate a little bit. We touched on it only just in the last few minutes, and we promised ourselves, as well as our listeners and viewers, that we'd get into it more this week. And so, if it's all right with you, I'd like to kick it off a little bit. Give me a few minutes. That's how we usually do it. Okay. And I usually ask. So just keeping tradition. So just giving some thought, let's go back a century. And don't worry, folks, I'm not going to take it year by year, month by month. But when I look at the major crises of the last 100 years, I see a completely different result. So, for example, after World War I, so many people were disillusioned with the enormity of the war, the length of the war, the sacrifice that had to be made, that we did, in fact, go on a binge, and we went off in two different directions. And one direction was the Roaring Twenties, and literally, it was a binge. It was a rejection of prohibition. It was a rejection of the traditional bonds and definitions of what it means to be a young woman. A good time was, quote, supposed to be had by all. By the same token, it was a lost generation as well. And we had young artists and intellectuals who expatriated, moved to Paris or other places, completely disillusioned by the high promises of the sacrifice of the war, and then left with death and disillusion. We head then to a period of depression and war, lots of years of suffering and sacrifice during World War II, and then afterward, a binge of a different sort. We settled into families and moved into suburbs and went to college, in fact, but by the same token, after years of deprivation during the Depression and then sacrifice during World War II, we bought refrigerators and we bought cars and we bought, in a few years after the war, television sets and consumer goods and consumer culture. And we had babies, the post-war baby boom. And so then we jump into the 70s and it's an energy crisis. And for the first time for many, Americans are being asked after a lengthy period of prosperity to slow it down, you know, to buy smaller cars, turn down the thermostat, stop wasting energy. And this is one that seems to have mattered, because even though we eventually, under Ronald Reagan, would start buying the large cars again, the minivans, as they were known back then, and the trucks, fact of the matter is that we became aware of the environment, and many Americans continued to conserve. And our kids were taught not to litter in school, and we began in the 80s to recycle, and there was a consciousness of the environment. So that's one change that lasted, and then we jump to 9/11. And we did, as I've alluded before, we at Zogby did some tracking polls within a couple of weeks after 9/11 to see how Americans would change. We saw changes and fears, new attitudes, not paranoia per se, but fear in the first few weeks and the first couple of months after 9/11. And then our tracking polls showed what was actually happening on the ground. And that is that aside from the changes in transportation, you know, and the airport security and the consciousness of global terrorism, Americans went back to their day-to-day lives pretty much and just opted to live. And so here we are now with the worst pandemic in 100 years. And perhaps an end in sight, but perhaps not an end in sight. And we talked a little bit, and I projected last week that there'd be some significant behavioral changes, that many of us would not go back to the handshaking, the hugging, the kissing, the large crowds, the binging. We would maintain some levels of social distancing and so on. But this week, I only want to hint at the fact that there were tremendous technological changes that were changing our lives already, and that what the pandemic has done is accelerated those changes. Many of us will not be going back to the workplace. Many of us will have robots as coworkers. Many of us will be facing trying to find different ways of earning a living and not working in offices or working on assembly lines or whatever the case may be. There's significant changes, sacrifices in privacy, telemedicine, that life will not be the same. Directly caused by the pandemic? Yep, in some instances, but accelerated or accelerating what already has been changing in our lives, yes, absolutely, it'll be a different America and a different humanity on the other side. All right, that's a lot, but I promised a big start. What do you think?
Well, I'm tempted to go through piece by piece, but I think I'll save our listeners a response to every point. I would probably take up the rest of the show. I'll pick up with what's that?
That's all right with me. I mean, feel free.
You know, I'll weave in and out, but it's yeah. I mean, evolution, right? Change is always happening. Technology is increasingly changing at a faster rate. And you've said, and I agree to this, that I think I agree, the genie's out of the bottle. But I don't think that's the central question. I don't think the question is, do we put the genie back in the bottle or do we let it out? I think is impossible. So I think the more central question is who has a say in how things go forward? Does it come from the technocratic elite, or do the people have a stake in this? And so we pick up with this most recent crisis, COVID-19, and almost immediately there were projections coming out. Not to say that this stuff wasn't really talked about, but it became public knowledge after COVID-19. I'm talking about the Great Reset, the Fourth Industrial Revolution. You know, the people who follow Davos and the World Economic Forum and maybe, you know, publications like The Economist have heard of the Fourth Industrial Revolution. But I think the lay person for the first time was introduced to this topic of the Great Reset. The Great Reset is basically taking our world and then just hitting the reset button. And then I've said, you know, kind of like it seems to be a controlled demolition and then building back better, as the phrase that was used with Boris Johnson, Joe Biden, and the head of the IMF and the head of the World Bank, and Justin Trudeau and the world over, the powerful leaders were saying the same thing, build back better. And that was actually the moniker that comes from the World Economic Forum. And so, you know, it jumped out at me, I think somewhere around the summer, June or July, that one, you know, there were these series of videos that were coming out on YouTube and other channels about the Great Reset. And one of them was 10 predictions. And what really jumped out at me, I'm not going to go through all of them, but one of them was, you will have no possessions and you will be happy. Well, I don't know. You know, that language is could be troublesome to some people to say. Maybe it could have been stated as, perhaps we will have no possessions, or it could be a wonderful thing if we had no possessions. But no, the language was, you will have no possessions and you will be happy. And, you know, among other things, there will be no consumption of meat. Meat will be replaced by, you know, lab grown meat, or whatever kind of, you know, 3D printed meat. And so you listen to the language, and for some people, it's almost like paternalistic. It's almost like arrogant. And I think that could be a tendency of some of these global institutions that you know, have these agendas and talk about them, but talk about them almost in a forceful way, like, this is the way forward. This is what's going to happen. But does it really happen like that? And keep in mind all the while, someone like Klaus Schwab, the head of the World Economic Forum, talks about stakeholder capitalism. Well, I'm sure he's elaborately laid out what stakeholder capitalism is, but to me, it's just kind of interesting that a name like that, stakeholder capitalism, to me, I would interpret as, oh, I have a stake in this. Because I'm a stakeholder, right? You're a stakeholder. We're all stakeholders. And so if I'm a stakeholder and we're all stakeholders, maybe we should have a say in this. Maybe we should get some feedback. Maybe the World Economic Forum should become a world public forum. Maybe there should be a vote. But you don't really see it talked about like that. You kind of see it talked about as, this is the agenda, this is what's going to happen, and this is how it's going to work. And that all ties back to a lot of what you were talking about with, you know, World War I and the energy crisis in the 70s. You know, if we go back to the Roaring 20s, few of us realize that Roaring 20s, a major backdrop of it was a credit expansion that was created by the Federal Reserve, the central bank, in artificially stimulating low interest rates, which creates readily available credit, which is allowed for this boom, this artificial boom, which allowed for the bust. That's important because we tend to look at the Roaring 20s as entirely a bottom-up social, socially motivated. But no, actually, a lot of it was top down. The same thing with the 70s energy crisis. Where did that come from? That is directly tied to Richard Nixon's policy of ending the Bretton Woods and taking the nation off of the gold standard. And within, you know, the same time period, you see inflation running rampant and stagflation. There's no question about it. That's what the result is. So we look at these changes and we think, oftentimes that they're organically grown. And while there's some truth to that, a lot of it is they're driven from the top down. And to wrap up my final point is, if we're really going to talk seriously about stakeholder capitalism, and we're going to talk about the future of humanity, then humanity has to have a say in it.
I learned a lot. And maybe I'll just modify and suggest that there would have been no discussion at and by the folks at the and types at the World Economic Forum if there had not been pressure from below. But in fact, there were a lot of people in the streets and a lot of social media and a lot of unrest and a lot of voting. And from my vantage point, very strange voting. In places, particularly throughout the West, that brought to the attention to the this elite that, hey, things do have to change or the public is not going to buy it. And so we have the actually not so much a mandate from the top as kind of, as some of our friends would say, a creative collision between the top and the bottom. And that this is the elite trying to hold on to something that it sees getting out of its control. And so stay tuned politically. There's, as Sam Cooke was said, a lot of change is going to come, right?
Change is going to come. And that was, I believe an Intelligencer issue number 8. So, yeah, you know, I think it was 8. Yeah, I mean, you could very well be correct in your assessment, but the thing that we have to address is that the obvious, how do I want to say, zeitgeist, if you will, really, I think today, and COVID, I think COVID poured the fuel on the fire, but it was already there. Because remember when we started this podcast, we were talking about riots in the streets globally, 2020, the year of the riot. And that all shut down with COVID. But, you know, scientific law says energy doesn't disappear, it only dissipates. So it was brewing while people were locked down. And it's not like that anger was just going to disappear. It probably only, you know, perhaps doubled, maybe not doubled, but grew. And so then it poured out, and it wasn't just the United States. It's in Europe. It's still in, I think it's still in Hong Kong and other places. The point that I'm trying to make is the zeitgeist is clearly the elite versus the anti-elite. And the more that the elite paint the anti-elite as crazy wackadoos, the more they can ensure that this will be a very nasty and bad situation. And so I would encourage any member of the elite, you know, whether that's the World Economic Forum, the IMF, the World Bank, the Bank of International Settlements, the folks at The Hague, the folks at the highest levels of the European Union, folks in DC, London, you get it. The Davos crowd, I would invite them to listen. Listen and understand the people who have massive amounts of distrust towards you. Don't dismiss them as crazy wackadoos. People are suffering. I would be so bold to say as to the elite, you are not suffering. Life is pretty good for you. Life is, heck, life is great for you. But for a lot of people, people are hanging on by their threads. So be careful of the language that you use. Be careful of the agendas that you speak about and how that they will be rolled out. Invite people to have a forum, because at the end of the day, we all value democracy. At the end of the day, we all value liberal democracy. And there's nothing liberal or democratic about shunning people, millions and millions and millions of people to the side and labeling them and looking at them in the worst possible way. All that's going to do is just justify their views that are already pretty negative.
So let me bring this back full circle and just simply suggest that I think we're fundamentally in agreement. And that agreement is that the world is changing. It's, and as you put, it's changing rapidly and it's been accelerating. And so now the tension is over who gets to control the change. On one hand, the strong movement for democracy, but democracy, as we could see, even going back as far as the founding fathers, is something that elites are very wary about. In fact, you could write a book from mobocracy. That's what John Jay and Thomas Jefferson talked about, to a basket full of deplorables, which is what Hillary talked about. And that all of these forces remain. This is the political battle of this era, populism versus anti-populism, or elite versus democratic forces. But by the same token, and fasten your seatbelts. Democracy is not always pretty, and democracy does tend to elect people that a lot of other folks don't like. And the troubling thing is that whether it's the elite or the folks in the virtual streets, we're at a point now where whoever loses more and more is unwilling to accept the results of a, quote, free and fair election. And so we've got a period of instability ahead of us. And perhaps some, one of the things we may talk about next week that we haven't really even alluded to, but in this context, is that it's 10 years now for the Arab Spring, and we're starting to learn more and more about how that movement is not dead. It's just sort of dormant and on hold, but it is not dead at all. Another hot spot to be watching. What do you think?
Well, you know, the Middle East is something I haven't followed in a while. But I mean, just look at Lebanon. I would imagine Egypt is still has a lot of tension. Of course, it's not just economics, it's not just politics, but it's also, right, it's also moving into the digital economy. And so, you know, I always made this comparison that if you looked at the first 1400 years of Christianity, right, the 1400 years was an important mark because, yeah, you had diversity within. I mean, a few centuries back, you had the break with the Orthodox Church. And then even in the first couple centuries, you had some theological battles over the nature of the Trinity. But really, the major point in the history of Christendom is Martin Luther. And it's not entirely Martin Luther. It's more so the invention of the printing press, which allowed for a dissemination of different interpretations and different ideas, and Christendom then split and splintered. I could possibly offend somebody of the Islamic faith, but I would just draw a comparison and say that, okay, you do have the split between Sunni and Shia. That's the most obvious split. But remember, Islam started in the 7th century, that is the 600s. Here we are in the 21st century. We're looking at 1400-1500 years. And what has happened in the last 20-30 years is basically the digital equivalent of the printing press. So I think that's the overarching trend of Islam, is perhaps perhaps, I'm not going to make a prediction, what we saw in Christendom, many different interpretations, many different splinterings. It's a possibility. I will say one more thing regarding democracy and mobocracy. You're absolutely right, and thank you for reminding me of that. I mean, obviously, the founding fathers started off this nation with people, you know, who own land, only they could vote because of their distrust towards the masses. And I'm gonna leave with this one quote. Ben Franklin said that when the voters discover that they can vote themselves money, that will herald the end of the republic.
Okay, let's leave it at that. Enjoy your trip, and you and I will talk before, but everybody, please spread this around. Share it if you like it. Tell us you like it, and keep writing your thoughts and ideas to us and to everybody else. Thanks. Have a good week. Next week's 59.
Thank you. And I'll just say, please, please share it, because there really is no other program like this. There are people much smarter than myself. I won't say smarter than my father, but much smarter than myself. But nobody's doing this, father and son. Nobody's doing this.
Have a good week.
Take care.
Bye-bye.